There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
It's August 2nd, 1998, a Sunday in the summertime, when the pace of Washington slows a bit. Congress goes on vacation, schools and colleges are on summer break, and interns have descended on the city for a few months. That summer, there's one story everyone seems to be talking about.
As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
That's President Bill Clinton addressing the nation the day he testified before the grand jury. At that point, independent counsel Ken Starr was still investigating Clinton. His report wouldn't come out until September. It was the biggest presidential scandal since Watergate. But this podcast isn't about Monica Lewinsky. It's about another intern who came to D.C. in 1998, 28-year-old Christine Mirzayon. She didn't come to Washington to work in the White House. Christine was a scientist, by all accounts brilliant. She had studied cell biology at Yale, and earlier that spring, she completed her Ph.D. in biochemistry at the University of California, San Francisco.
She was at the very end. It was a summer intern at the National Academy of Sciences. She had spent the summer there. The only time in our relationship where we were separated. I was still finishing up my PhD at UCSF.
That's David Hackos, Christine's husband at the time. He was planning to join her in D.C. after he finished his PhD. He'd lined up a postdoc opportunity at the National Institutes of Health in the fall in nearby Bethesda, Maryland.
So during that summer, and I was kind of packing up the house because we had found an apartment that we were going to live in Woodley Park in D.C., She had done an internship, and she got this very, very prestigious additional internship that she had not yet started from AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, where she was going to work in the Senate for a senator, basically, to kind of learn how to do what her passion was to basically work on science policy. So she had not yet started that, but she won that fellowship. And that's why she was so excited about going into that area that she also managed to get a summer intern before to kind of get ready, you know.
David and Christine were still newlyweds that summer. Her internship in D.C. was the first time they were separated since they'd met in the university library at UCSF. He had doubts about her going to D.C. without him, but Christine had a sense of mission. She was passionate about using science to solve the national and political problems facing the country, and she thought getting to D.C. early would help her make connections. Christine grew up in Newport Beach, California. She'd been born in Iran, but when she was a child, her parents fled the country with her and her sister after the Shah was deposed in the 1979 revolution. Later, her parents moved to Vancouver, Canada. Through Yale, grad school, and now her summer in D.C., Christine had a routine.
On Sunday, she always called her mom. Okay, it was just like her once a week, call her mom in the morning. And so I didn't know anything was wrong until her mom called me and said, "Oh, I can't get in touch with Christine. She's not answering her phone. Do you know? Have you heard from her?" And we had talked the day before, so I said, "Oh yeah, I talked to her yesterday, I didn't think there was anything wrong. I thought, oh, she's probably just forgot to call you back or whatever. But it was unusual because it was such a consistent thing that she did."
David had talked to Christine the night before. She was staying in a dorm on the Georgetown campus, Neville's Hall at 35th and O Streets. At the time they talked, she was heading over to a friend's house nearby for a cookout with other interns from the program. David didn't know the interns very well. He had only been to DC once. Actually, just a week or two before that Sunday. She showed him her dorm room. They went out to eat. Went to a movie. David remembers it was Good Will Hunting. After the call from Christine's mom, David tried to reach his wife at her dorm room. Personal cell phones weren't all that common at the time. As the day went on, something just didn't feel right.
This was Sunday. During that day, I started trying to get in touch with her. I would call her, leave messages. I called her. I figured out how to call her roommate. And I asked her roommate whether, or sweet mate or whatever, whether she had seen Christine, and she hadn't seen her, but she didn't know for sure that she was not there. Basically over the day, I kept calling and calling. And then I got to the point where I just could not believe that this was just so out of character for Christine, that I didn't believe that I thought that there must be something wrong. And so basically, I decided towards night, because it basically got to the point where it was night in the East Coast and I was in San Francisco. So it's a 3-hour difference. And I thought, okay, she's not even home and it's nighttime. I mean, it's impossible. So I called, the first thing I did was I called the campus, the Georgetown campus police. And I reported her missing at that point. And I gave them some information, and I didn't call the DC police. And then I booked an airplane to fly there the next morning. And I didn't want to call other people because I was afraid that I'd be waking them up and it was really late. So in the morning, I took a cab to the airport and I called my mom, basically. And I told her, can you call these people, including Bruce Alberts, just call them and see if you can track down what is happening with Christine. I'm going to be on the flight, so I won't be able to call while I'm on the airplane.
Bruce Alberts was the head of the National Academies. Christine had once been his graduate student, and he was instrumental in getting her the fellowship.
And then I jumped on the airplane, and, you know, it's a, whatever, 3-4 hour flight or whatever. So when I landed on the intercom on the airplane, they basically said, David Hekos, please see, there's somebody that is going to meet you at the gate. Please see the person or whatever. And it turned out to be the DC police.
David is a scientist too. You can hear how methodical, logical he is when dealing with a moment that would send most people into a panic. For David, the voice on the intercom was the moment the terrible reality hit home.
I was really worried, obviously. I felt like there was a good chance that this was just some sort of, you know, nothing bad happened. And I ended up, you know, flying all the way across the country for no good reason, right? Obviously, I flew across the country, so obviously I was pretty worried. But the moment I heard that voice on the intercom, I broke down crying because to me that meant that, okay, something really bad has happened. And then I exited the airplane and the DC police were there to meet me at the gate. They took me into the United Airlines red carpet room, and that's where when they told me that Christine had been, that they think that they had found the body of Christine.
Police told David Christine's body had been found the day before, the day she didn't call home. She was found nearly naked in a wooded area off a busy street called Canal Road, just yards away from the gates of Georgetown's campus. There was evidence she had been sexually assaulted. She had been beaten with a massive rock found near her body. It appeared to the police that Christine was walking alone a long canal road the night she left the barbecue, when her killer came from behind and dragged her into the woods. I'm Paul Wagner, and this is Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare series.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Paul Wagner. In August of 1998, I was working for WTOP Radio, the all-news station here in Washington, D.C., and the producer of this podcast. I reported on the murder of Christine Mirzayan back when it happened. From time to time, I checked in on the investigation, and after 5 years with the murder still unsolved, it became a cold case. By that point, I'd made the switch from radio to TV and taken a job with the local Fox affiliate, where I stayed for 21 years. I filed a report for the station about Christine's killing, a story that featured for the first time the lead detective, a man you will hear from later in this episode. Then, in 2011, 13 years after the murder, still unsolved, I broke a major story on the case, which changed the direction of the investigation. The FBI got involved, and Christine's murder got national attention. But back in 1998, on that hot August day, Christine's body laid undiscovered for more than 15 hours.
We were chatting and, you know, just talking about whatever. And I just casually looked towards the canal and I saw what I thought was a mannequin. And I thought, well, it's near Georgetown. It's probably some kind of fraternity prank or something, you know. And so we started keeping on walking, and I said, well, maybe we should check. And so my wife and my friend stayed on the sidewalk there, or on the side of the road. And I walked in about 20 feet, and I could see flies around the head. And so I didn't get any closer. I just walked back, and we went back to the convenience store and called the police.
That's Daniel Snawfield, the first person to spot Christine's body in a wooded area not far from her dorm room on the campus of Georgetown University. The exact spot is just yards away from the notorious staircase featured in the movie The Exorcist.
It was a nice day. It really was a nice day. It was sunny. I had assumed duty. I signed the members there. Cleanup assignments, and we're just trying to get the day started, more or less, when the call came in for a medical local adjacent to Georgetown University.
That's retired D.C. firefighter Jeff Stauffer. He was in charge of Engine 5 that day and remembers the call coming into the station.
We responded, and upon arrival, we were met by a male and a female who directed us to a body that was laying in the copse of trees, a small copse of trees adjacent to the campus. Walking up to the body, it became apparent that there had been a sexual assault, and by the way her clothes were disarrayed, and that she had was deceased. Her pupils were fixed. There was significant trauma to her head, and there was also blood on an adjacent rock next to her head. At that point, I directed my driver who had accompanied me to step away from the body. We walked back. I communicated using my radio to fire communications, asking for MPD to be dispatched forthwith, and a few seconds later, fire communications came back saying that police department wanted more additional information, at which point I said I would call them landline and jogged to the Exxon station immediately north of the Copes of Trees, went into the gas station, used the payphone to communicate the exact details and nature of the situation.
Stauffer says he didn't want to broadcast the graphic details over the radio, but wanted police to know this wasn't what police called a natural death. Detectives needed to step it up.
Yeah, man, it was hot today. That was our third murder of the day already.
That's Dean Combi, the D.C. homicide detective who would take the lead investigating Christine Merzion's murder. He's retired from the police department now, and because of COVID, when I interviewed him last fall, we sat at a table outside, so you'll hear some background noise during our interview.
And we get up there, and it was probably maybe 150 yards west of the gas station. That's right there at on Canal Road there, or actually it's M Street Extended, I think, and that's where Whitehurst Freeway comes in right there. And about 150 yards or so west, and the ground had a lot of ivy. There was a lot of ivy there, I remember. And it was, there was an old brick wall that was, I guess, some sort of retaining wall or something that basically bordered the edge of the thing there, which was probably about 50 yards back, I would guess, something like that. Was, sort of a shade-dappled crime scene, if you want to call it that, because, like I said, there was a lot of trees there, and it was very overgrown. I remember you could see her, though, because the sunlight kind of beamed just on a little spot where she was, you know. So when I get up there, and there were some 2D guys there, and, they would tell me about the person that found her and stuff. So we arranged for them to, go give a statement of homicide. And so when I got up there, it was pretty apparent, right away that there had been a sexual assault. And her entire head was just crushed. And when I say crushed, I mean crushed. Because, it was probably no more than that thick. Maybe 3 inches.
Could you see the rock that was used right away?
Yeah, it was right there. It was basically, within a foot of her head there, And you could see blood and stuff all over it. And so... we processed the scene, they photographed it, and, retrieved her clothes, stuff like that. There was no identification, no purse, and anything like that. So we had no idea who she was. I want to say she still had an anklet on one leg. She was pretty much nude.
She was on her back, with her arms slightly spread, an unfastened bra wrapped around her neck. Her dark green pants, shirt, and underwear were tangled up and lying on the ground, just to the left of her head. To the right, a short distance away, was a large rock covered in blood. Nearby, police found an old boot. There were cobwebs inside. They also found a weathered pair of pants and a slightly wet black purse strap. It appeared the murder took place amongst a pile of trash, but police collected it all, including a juice bottle, 2 beer cans, a 2-liter Coke bottle, a piece of string, and a piece of foil. Detective Combi noticed something distinctive about her clothes.
They were inside out. So like if you taking clothes off a kid, when you put them to bed and you just pull them off, they come inside out. That's the way her clothes were.
And you took from that what?
That she was not conscious at the time. That her clothes were taken off, were removed.
But it was,
because if somebody had told them to, told you to take your clothes off, you don't pull them off inside out. You pants and stuff like that, you just don't. So that I kind of that was sort of just a sort of a working assumption, if you want to call it that, you know.
But that scene, and when you first took a look at it, it was pretty clear to you that this was whoever had attacked her had been a it had been a vicious attack.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We didn't know how. I mean, I didn't know how much the rock weighed. I mean, the rock was probably, I'd say probably 20 inches at least, maybe, and maybe 10 or 11 inches thick. So, and we weighed it later, and it was 73 pounds. So
what did that say to you about the strength of the person?
Someone was very strong to be able to do that, you know, to lift that up and smash somebody's head like that. And during the autopsy, we discovered that, well, what it appeared, it was probably at least three, she was stuck at least three times with the rock. So, you know.
When investigators went through her things, they could find no identification. There was no wallet, no purse. Had the attack started out as a robbery? If Christine's credit cards were stolen and later used, police could track those purchases and possibly come up with some solid leads.
I was off. It was on a Sunday, if I'm not mistaken, the second, and I was off on Sunday, Monday. But I remember when I saw it on the news, the murder, because of the location, it was kind of unusual, you know, up there on Canal Road up in Far 2D. Wasn't known for a whole lot of murders, let alone that violent of a crime. So, of course, it was all over the news.
That's retired D.C. Police Homicide Commander Mike Farish. In the summer of 1998, he was a sergeant working patrol in what's known as 2D. The Metropolitan Police Department is divided into seven districts, and officers assigned to the 2D station patrol not only Georgetown, but some of the most expensive and exclusive neighborhoods in the city. By August of 1998, the murder rate in Washington, D.C. had been steadily falling. Just a few years before, the city was known as the murder capital. From 1989 to 1993, the city recorded well over 400 homicides a year. By 1997, it had fallen to just over 300. And in 1998, the city would record 260 murders, the lowest number in more than a decade. That summer, the police department was also trying to put an embarrassing scandal in the rear view. The chief of police, Larry Soulsby, had resigned in disgrace after his friend and roommate, Lieutenant Jeff Stowe, was arrested for blackmailing closeted gay men. Stowe was accused of sitting outside gay bars looking for cars with child seats inside and then extorting the owners for cash. The new mayor wanted more stability, and so he hired an outsider, the Chicago Police Department's second in command at the time, Charles Ramsey. The D.C. Police Department was now under new leadership, and Ramsey was trying to right the ship. In Tony Georgetown, where murders were extremely rare, the rape and murder of a woman who had apparently been abducted off the street was big news, and it would bring intense scrutiny. As Detective Comby was going over evidence collected from the crime scene, he got a heads up on a name.
Shortly after I got back to the office, and we were not at 1D, we were at headquarters, I remember now. So it was shortly after we got back to the office that we got a call from 2D indicating that there was they had taken, or were in the process of taking a missing person report from her husband, from Christine's husband. Because they had a routine that she would call him like every Sunday, you know, and she hadn't called him. And so he had called and they said that, I guess they spoke to somebody else in the dorm where she was staying, and they were like, we haven't seen her, you know. So he called in a missing person report, and he gave a description of her and stuff like that, which was consistent with what we had.
David Hackos, who had flown in from San Francisco, greeted by police at the gate, positively identified Christine. They asked you to go to the morgue?
I did end up going to the morgue, yeah, identify the body.
Oh, that must have been terrible.
Yeah, that was extremely difficult, extremely difficult.
Detective Comby was there, too. By that point, armed with monstrous details of what happened to Christine. He says a facial reconstruction was done, and David was able to identify his wife from a photograph, along with personal items found on her body, including her wedding ring. The cause of death was blunt force trauma from being beaten with the massive rock. Christine had also been raped. The medical examiner found semen, and there was also evidence that Christine's attacker put her into a chokehold, and she may have lost consciousness before she was killed, confirming Detective Comby's suspicions about the way her clothes had been removed. Once they had identified Christine as the victim, police began retracing her steps from the night before. We know that she talked to David that Saturday as she was getting ready for the get-together. It was a small barbecue hosted by some of the other young women who were taking part in the scientific internship program. The barbecue took place on 44th Street in the backyard of a Tudor-style row house on a charming tree-lined street in the Foxhall Village section of Northwest D.C. It's about a 15-minute walk from Christine's dorm in Neville's Hall. One of the women who was there, another of the interns that year, is a woman named Mary Cartwright. I exchanged emails with Mary, but she didn't want to do an interview for this podcast. She said, to this day, she finds the subject just too difficult to talk about. She said it really wasn't a party. It was more like a low-key socializing. There were four or five other young women there. They were making shrimp and chicken kebabs, another young woman later told the Washington Post. Christine made couscous and tahini. Mary Cartwright remembers they were all approaching the end of their internships and they were talking about their future plans. At one point, they discussed the national obsession, Clinton and Lewinsky. In fact, one friend remembered it was Christine who brought it up, asking the others what they thought. She said she thought all the media attention was distracting from more important issues on the national agenda, the friend later told the Washington Post. At about 10 p.m., the cookout was winding down. The women decided to go out. Mary thinks they went salsa dancing. They were headed to a nightclub in the Adams Morgan neighborhood called Heaven and Hell. Christine didn't want to go. Mary remembers she wasn't feeling well. Nothing major. Mary can't remember exactly what. Perhaps a headache. Mary says she also can't remember if two of the women who had cars offered Christine a ride. But Christine said she wanted to walk home instead. And they didn't insist. The women just didn't conceive of that part of Georgetown being unsafe. Mary says some of the women had walked at night in the same area themselves. Mary says she has survivor's guilt about not insisting Christine get a ride back to her dorm. It's one of those what-ifs. What if she had taken a different way back to Georgetown? David doesn't think Christine had ever been to the house on 44th Street before the night she was killed, but he wasn't surprised to learn the route she had chosen to get back to the dorm, down that narrow sidewalk of Canal Road.
She must have felt like she wanted to go a different route on the way home. And Christine was a fearless person, so she was unusual. She was a street tough kind of person. Mm-hmm. And so she felt, I mean, she would not have been afraid to go down that route, even though it does, you know, as you probably noticed when you were walking down there, it's not particularly pedestrian friendly type of environment, right? It's next to a busy street and there's a forest on one side.
Christine left the house where the party was just after 10 o'clock and walked down Foxhall Road towards Canal Road. Now, when you get to Canal Road, all along the left-hand side, it's nothing but a wooded area, although it's a very busy road. It's two lanes in each direction. And then she would have come up to an entrance to the university, but she chose not to go up there and take that route. Instead, she continued up to Canal Road where I'm standing now, which is a wooded area with a very steep hillside on the left-hand side, and then the busy canal road here to the right. I can see the Potomac River.
I can also see the Key Bridge, and we're just steps from the heart of Georgetown. Now that's where Christine was grabbed and dragged here into the woods.
How could something like this happen? In this part of town, right off a busy roadway, so close to a university, is it possible someone saw something? In the first few days after Christine's murder, police were operating blind, and then their first potential break. After Christine's murder, police asked the public for help. They went door to door in Georgetown. They set up a roadblock on Busy Canal Road one evening, stopping traffic on the same road Christine had been walking on, handing out flyers. On the off chance that one of those same drivers might have been on Canal Road on the night of August 1st and seen something. It wasn't much, but you have to remember in 1998, surveillance cameras were not nearly as prevalent as they are today. And soon, a witness came forward. On the Saturday night Christine was attacked, a man named Peter Fraschetti was walking his dog on nearby Prospect Street.
He and his mother were walking their dogs up there, and they heard her scream for help. Well, they don't know if it was her. That was our assumption, it was her.
That's Detective Comby.
They heard somebody scream for help, help, help. But they thought it was some kids fooling around from the gas station or whatever, and so they didn't call the police or anything, you know. There was a Fairfax County major and his wife who were driving on Canal Road. And they saw her, or what we believe to be her anyway, walking. It was just about the entrance, the back entrance to Georgetown back there. They have a traffic light there now, which wasn't there at the time. And it was that driveway that goes up to where the field is, you know, it's just about there. And they saw a male, appeared to be African American, walking, you know, 50 yards or so behind her. I mean, he wasn't like right up on or anything like that, just walking along. Didn't really seem to be out of place. They said he was wearing like a polo shirt and like khakis or something, you know, or jeans or whatever, but didn't really seem to be out of place.
But this major, something got him suspicious enough that he decided to give you guys a call.
Well, because we had put out there was a press appeal about if anybody's seen her or anything like that, so he's like, you know, when they saw had her picture in the paper, or not in the paper, but on the news or whatever, he was like, you know, that looks like the girl, you know, his wife or both were like, that looks like the girl we saw, you know, so they called. Well, the wife noticed, she didn't really notice his face so much, but she said he was very well built, you know, because her son wrestled or something like that. So he was very muscular. She said he's a very muscular guy, but not real big, but just very muscular. And the major got a, you know, better look at his face. But it was just, you know, as you're driving by, you know, so.
And he gave you a composite sketch.
Well, eventually.
Detective Comby contacted the FBI, and they lined up the same artist who had worked up the sketch of the Oklahoma City bomber, a man who would turn out to be Timothy McVeigh. Except the police major and his wife had left the country, gone to Europe for a month, so the composite sketch would have to wait. Meanwhile, police were chasing down every lead. At one point, looking into a report, someone had been phoning in obscene threats earlier that summer to the Georgetown Library. Could it be related? Investigators had to collect everything. They didn't know what was relevant. As August rolled into September, and September into October, police had no suspects and no good leads to follow. Detective Comby worked with what he had, and what he had was a file full of nagging questions.
He had to have been covered in blood, you know, because I was always like, how did he get away? You know, where did he go to get, you know, because you know, he would have had a lot of blood on him. Yeah, you know, probably at least from the waist down anyway, you know.
Detective Combi is speculating about the killer. How could he have gotten away from the scene covered in blood like that?
I think he just zipped right up behind her and, you know, and grabbed her and yanked her into those, up under those trees in the dark, which implied some familiarity to me. Like he was, had, you know, had some familiarity to the neighborhood. So, I mean, I was looking at, you know, people that had been arrested up in there, and I went to Georgetown and pulled all their employee records of people who were working and was running background checks on them. You know, I mean, I did a lot of work, you know, and it's just nothing, just you get nothing.
Forensic investigators swabbed Christine's body for DNA, a potential link to her killer, but DNA was still fairly new. The National FBI database to collect DNA had only launched that year, and D.C. didn't have its own crime lab. It used the FBI, and that meant long waits. Federal cases took priority over D.C. crimes most of the time. Plus, the testing was less sensitive then, which meant you needed a lot of DNA material to test, and that meant Detective Combi had to wait and wait. While he was waiting, Detective Combi had a hunch about Christine's missing wallet. He thought it might be at the bottom of the C&O Canal, which is right across the street from where she was killed and her body was found.
I tried to get the park police to, you know, drain off that end so we could look for her purse and stuff in there. And the Interior Department said, it's a no. We're not doing that. And so...
Why did you think that it might be in the canal?
Because that's the closest place that of concealment, you know.
So you knew she was missing her purse and mm-hmm. what else?
I think she had like a watch and like an anklet. We're still on her body and maybe a necklace. I can't remember. I think she had a necklace, but her purse and ID. You know, I knew she had credit cards. You know, from her husband and stuff like that. All that stuff. You know, wallet. All that stuff was gone, you know, and the people said that she had it with her when she left. So he either took it or disposed of it. Well, the most logical place to dispose of it is the canal right there because somebody would have found it if it was, you know, because we basically did a line canvas all through there. So if it had just been, you know, thrown away in the immediate area, we would have found it, you know. Well, anyway, you know, the Interior Department said, nah, no. So,
But you had an idea that perhaps it was at the bottom of the canal.
Yeah.
Simply because of the location of where the murder took place and it would have been easy to toss it into the river.
Right.
Into the water.
Exactly. And so probably 3 or 4 months later, I guess they decided to drain it because they had to, I guess there was a lot of underwater plant growth in there. And so they had to go clean it out every once in a while. And, of course, they found her purse.
Wow.
And, you know, her credit cards and stuff were still in there.
He didn't take anything.
He didn't take anything.
He just took it and threw it in the water.
Put a piece of brick in it to make it sink.
Oh.
And threw it in the water.
Okay.
So.
Clearly that says he was looking to make sure that you'd have trouble identifying her right off the bat.
Yep. And you know, with all that kind of stuff, it was just kind of spinning my wheels and not really getting anywhere.
For Christine's husband, David Hakos, life was now a series of doors he never wanted to open. From grieving his wife's death to planning a funeral. And then what?
There was a lot of news coverage when it happened, but I think that within a week, the news coverage had kind of disappeared. There was a little bit of the scientific community was still... talking about it for a little bit longer because they were in shock. I mean, everybody was so in shock.
David decided to stick with his original plan and took the job in D.C., where he lived for a couple of years, eventually moving back to the West Coast.
I would kind of talk to the D.C. police every once in a while, every few months, say, over the years to kind of get updates on the case. And then sometimes they would contact me to ask questions. At one point they had thought that they had identified the perpetrator. And they were completely convinced, but the DNA didn't match.
Detective Comby.
There was a guy that got arrested for a sexual assault on Capitol Hill. And he had assaulted some high government official. She was, you know, worked in the federal government and was like an assistant secretary or something or other. And she actually heard him coming in into the house and called 911. And he came up and basically took the phone from her, you know, and assaulted her. Then went through her purse and took some money out of her purse and walked downstairs, and the popo was waiting for him at the door.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So he got caught. He was 16 years old.
Oh, gosh.
And we started, you know, when I started backgrounding him and stuff like that, I mean, he lawyered up almost immediately. So I, you know, couldn't talk to him, but he, when I started backgrounding him, he had a number of assaults on young boys when he was incarcerated, and he was putting them, he was using chokeholds on them and putting them to sleep before he was assaulting him. So, needless to say, because of the autopsy thing, inference, you know, that there is, that somebody used a chokehold on her to knock her out, we were pretty interested in that guy. But they, you know, they got swabs. We did blood draw and stuff like that. You know, back then it wasn't buccal swab. You had to actually go get blood from them.
Yeah.
So.
Great. Oh, it's over there.
Yeah.
Ugh. That's killing.
So.
Me. That engine you're hearing is landscapers. Doing interviews in the age of COVID comes with all sorts of outdoor sounds. Now, that DNA sample Dean had mentioned.
Anyway, it eventually that came back as a negative.
Earlier in this episode, I introduced you to Mike Farish, a D.C. police officer who was working in patrol in the 2nd District when Christine was killed. Farish eventually rose through the ranks to become a supervisor in the homicide squad before taking over as commander of the unit. He's retired now and living in Kentucky. We talked over Zoom one day in late 2020, and I asked him about the work that went into Christine's case.
Dean was very methodical, very thorough, very dogged. He would work a case and work it hard. I mean, you know, I've known Dean a long time. There was one of those sayings, you know, in the police department, you got 10% that are that top notch that you never even think about, especially when you become a boss, because they're always plugging away. They're just incredibly determined. You got another group, you know, the lower percent that you got to worry about, you got to stay on top of. And then most everyone else fits in the middle. And, you know, I'd like to say, with a few exceptions in homicide, you really didn't have that bottom 10%. That bottom 10% in homicide were better than a lot of other people elsewhere, because it wasn't a unit you could just go in and be a slap in and not do your work, because someone was going to be on your rear end constantly. Dean was definitely in that upper grouping. You knew if he had a case, he was going to work it. He was going to work hard.
What's a slap?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was an old saying that we had on the department. It was S-L-A-P, and it stood for Sorry Lazy Ass Police.
And was that shared liberally, or were there a few of those?
There were a few, but, you know, like I said, I was lucky enough. I spent so much of my career in homicide. You really didn't get to go to homicide and be a slap. It just wasn't going to, if you snuck in somehow, you weren't going to last, because your peers weren't going to let you last, let alone your bosses.
In Christine's case, Dean says he was mostly spinning his wheels. Nothing had panned out. After just a few months of following every solid lead, there was nowhere to go. Detective Comby had DNA and not much else, so he waited for a long time, years. And this is where the story seemed to end. A brazen, senseless murder and a dead end. But eventually, the DNA that investigators took from Christine's body would point them in a new direction. Investigators learned the same perpetrator who pulled Christine off Canal Road and killed her was also responsible for a series of terrifying attacks on women just across the border of Washington, D.C. in Montgomery County, Maryland. But at the time investigators made that link, those attacks, which I'm going to tell you about in the next few episodes, were also unsolved. Police were dealing with an unsub. That's police speak for an unknown subject. If you watch crime shows, it's a term you may have heard before. What it meant for police, instead of the name or identity of their suspect, a big frustrating question mark. They had DNA from multiple crime scenes. It all matched the same person. But they had no idea who this man, this unknown subject, was. How was that possible? How could someone commit a series of vicious attacks and at least one murder and not get caught? Now, about those attacks in Montgomery County, you might assume they happened after Christine's murder, but they actually began years before.
I was babysitting. I had just started college, freshman year of college, and I was babysitting.
In the next episode, I'll take you back to 1991, where this story really begins.
I'm always like, where do I get started?
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written by me, Paul Wagner, with editorial assistance from Jack Moore, Julia Ziegler, and Craig Schwab. This episode would not be possible without the help of David Hakos, Dean Comby, Mike Farish, and Jeff Stauffer. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Our show relies on people like you leaving ratings and reviews on Apple to help us climb the podcast charts and attract new listeners. We hope if you like what you hear, you will take a minute to do so. If you have questions or comments about the show, send us an email through our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. We are also on Twitter and Facebook at American Nightmare Pod. The music in this show is Ethereal Thoughts by Olive Musique and Steadfast by Moments. And as always, thanks for listening.